Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
Hi, my name is Christina Vo, and I am the author of My Vietnam, Your Vietnam. And I'm really glad to be here chatting with all of you about creativity and identity and more.
Hi, I'm Kyuling Carolyn Valverde, professor at UC Davis, and my work is on transnationalizing Vietnam, which is looking at the culture flows back and forth from Vietnam.
Hi, I'm Chung Chung. I am a writer and an artist. My book is Book of the Other. How to Exit is forthcoming in 2026. I'll use this opportunity to plug my upcoming show on June 6th, which is in San Francisco. It is going to be called Loud, colon, because sometimes you just have to live. So please come.
Hi, I'm Andrew Lam, a longtime writer, journalist based in San Francisco. My latest book is called Stories from the Edge of the Sea. And I just published it last month, and I'm about to go on a mini book tour. Well, I've been on one, but glad to be back in the Bay Area. I spent some time in Vietnam and, back in America in a very different time.
You know, we'll kick off this conversation with a question that I talk to Christina quite often about. And I think Kyuling and Andrew, we've touched upon this topic of April 30, 1975, which is 50 years after the end of the war. And now I want to really emphasize the movement of creativity, but wondering if we can move forward without pain, without trauma, without the war. Is that a possibility in our community?
The answer is no for me.
Why?
Because we're addicted to the despair of that pain. And I do believe that we are somewhat addicted to the despair of that pain. And it's not just us, but it is expected of us. I mean, to be honest, it is expected in one form or another from the brown and black body in this society. It's like my publisher or my agent says to me very matter of fact and bluntly, it's like they want more black and brown writers in publishing, but they just want you to be. They don't want you to question or ask or advance your thinking in a way that is compelling. So what do? We perform for our meals. We show up and we cry. You know.
Love this. Christina, you were right. June is hilarious. I don't know if I entirely agree, but I would love to hear everybody else.
I don't disagree, Jung, as with many things, there's, both sides. I struggle, and I think many of us struggle in the academy against a very strong narrative that Vietnam is related to a war. So I literally created in 2015 a center called New Vietnam Studies, and it is a very daunting task of myself and my colleagues, allies, friends, peers to set a counter narrative, which is actually just documenting history, recent history, contemporary history, and moving towards the future with the youth. And we, I think, still struggle with this very dominant narrative of what Vietnam is. But the work I do is looking at, you know, the past 50 years and moving forward. And the truth of the matter is, for Vietnam, it's, you know, the war ended a long time ago, and many generations don't have any sense of the war. And in fact, myself being a 1.5 coming in 1975 as a, you know, a 5-year-old, I didn't know there was a war in Vietnam. I mean, talk about, you know, some sort of like naive privilege, but I didn't know there was a war, and I learned the war through Hollywood films, you know? And so, I would say that I don't disagree with Jung. I think in the arts and academia, there is going against this perception of what it should be, but I think there's a critical mass, and hopefully it'll be more vocal post 50th anniversary that will change the direction and trajectory. And I think our group here, already does that. Maybe that's why you congregated us in this way. So that's my answer.
So I actually remember the war. My father fought in the war. I saw the war myself. So I think there is obligations and there are performance, in meaning that I couldn't help but write about what I experienced the beginning. So I'm one of those people who began writing before anyone else practically. And so when I did write about the war and refugees, I was among the first to write about it. And it was collected in the book called Perfume Dreams years ago. And that experience as a boat, not as a refugee, not a boat person, I flew over, but as a refugee and as someone who remembered a war and living with a father who fought that war in America and carried his wounds, I felt obligated to write about those things. But I was thinking about your question, and I was looking at my books over the years. A second book is called Easy to West, and it's more joyful because I look at how we bring our culture to America as well as our wounds. So we have banh mi and pho, and we bring our food, fruits or vegetables, and we grow them in, you know, in Central Valley, and we change American perspectives as well. And then my latest book, Stories from the Edge of Sea, is more a study of second generation than first. And in it, I explore sexuality, you know, heartbreaks and sexuality. So even within my own life, as someone who was a refugee, who experienced war, I am moving slowly away from it as much as I can as someone who was marked by that war. But I think there is this performance thing where people who didn't experience the war and feel obligated or feel like that's how you get into the literary life or get famous or something. And that's a little bit more of like a sense of being forced or feeling forced because of that history that is belonging to their community. But I don't think you should have to write about war or refugee experience if that's not your obligation, you know, if that's not the thing that you suffer from. And so there is that. But I have a story to share is that a friend of mine used to read letters to, you know, when you apply to schools and you write about your background, and he was at UC Davis and he was reading a lot of Vietnamese second generation writing why they should get in. And they often quoted their parents who were boat people. And then, you know what he said to me? He said, Andrew, I love you. I love your people. But if I have to read another, my mother was a boat person, I'm going to throw up. Because everyone was using that narrative to get in, you know? And so there is that performative situation as well.
Christina, do you want to say something?
Yeah.
I think for me, it's not so, you know, when I think about the war, it's like, it's a more like indirect lingering impact of the war. Because I don't really want to write about the war either, but I do. What was important to me to understand, like in the second book, is my relationship with my father. And then by extension, that is the war, because my father is so, you know, immersed in thinking about the legacy of South Vietnam and the war. But what I find interesting, I think we're still talking about it because I think there are a lot of ways in which there are a lot of misunderstandings between generations. I mean, even with, I even see this now with my dad, because, I told some of you guys, Alex Tai is trying to get my dad to go to Vietnam. in the summer, a group of students want to film, you know, a parent-child duo returning, but have it reversed where the child's been back to Vietnam and the parent hasn't. And Alex asked me, like, why does your dad not want to go back to Vietnam? And I gave him my understanding, what my assumptions that, and I realized, like, in a lot of this, and I think a lot of parent children, there are a lot of misunderstandings that have happened because of this trauma, the lingering effect of the war. But anyway, when Alex spoke to my dad last night, he called me afterwards and he explained why my dad didn't want to go to Vietnam, which was not the reason that I gave to Alex. And I thought it was so beautiful. And he even said it was so beautiful because the reason he does not want to go back to Vietnam was not because of any personal wound or fear. It's the fact that he wants Vietnam to recognize the millions of people that were lost in this war. And that's his value. Like, that is the reason why he's not going to Vietnam, because he wants an acknowledgement of those losses, and he wants to stand with his people who, and I didn't even didn't even come across my mind. So anyway, for me, it's not the war per se, but like that we do have this lingering legacy of war that we have to resolve in terms of our understanding of our relationships with our family that impact all of our relationships with everyone and how we show up.
So I think the complications of that reality is really important to bear witness to, which is, you know, Andrew and I did that event in San Jose where it was called the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. All over Vietnam, it was the reunification and a national holiday. And those are the two realities that perhaps will never be reconciled in our existence.
Yeah.
But it's not, I don't feel the need to be on one side or the other of that equation. What I want to understand is the complications of existence that happened there. And on that note, I will say that I am guilty of being one of those professors who encourage my students to write about their experiences of the Vietnam War as well. It's like, it's a natural inclination, right? It's like, I had a Vietnamese student come into me and hand me a poem in which he writes about, you know, going home and standing underneath the banyan tree and feeling the pangs of hunger in his stomach. And as I was reading this, he was standing there laughing. And I said, and I looked at him, I said, you have never been to Vietnam, back to Vietnam. He goes, he has never even been to Vietnam. He was born here. And he was laughing. He goes, that's the shit they want, Trung. And they're laughing at me. That's the shit they want. So I'm giving it to them. They said they're going to publish it. Right? It's like, and I'm thinking to myself,
is this on Vu?
Sorry. No, this is Vin.
Okay.
And I'm laughing. I'm laughing along with him, but I'm also feeling my own guilt in that, because I think at some point in our conversation, I also said to you, why are you writing like Shakespeare? You should write about your experiences.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He writes like Shakespeare because that's who he is.
Mm.
And we don't afford him the imagination to be that, right? Which is the thing that I struggle with.
That's to riff off that, you know, I've been teaching over 20 years, courses like, you know, the Southeast Asian experience, for example. In this quarter, I'm teaching the 50th anniversary and its legacies. But in all these classes, you know, it's funny that you're talking about this performative or thinking that there is, that is what the audience wants, right? For my class, it's something else much deeper. It's almost like carrying this history, the weight of this history on subsequent now 3-4 generations. So the first day of class, I always say this. I say, you know, you did not ask this of me. It's completely unsolicited. You don't need this from me, but I'm going to give this to you. You have my permission to write your history. You have my permission to write your experience. And it's just as valid as anything your parents or your grandparents experience. You don't have to carry the weight of the war or these monumental atrocities and displacement and all these awful things that you feel are so much more traumatic or tragic than your history. whatever it looks like, whatever you feel, good, bad, ugly, you know? And there is this collective silence. Yeah. And, you know, for a few, there are tears. And then afterwards, they reflect and they let me know that, you know, thank you. And I really don't need to give them that permission. But the fact that they thought, and maybe because that is the, what if they've been told that they need to carry on this history that is not entirely theirs, and or they've never been to Vietnam, or they weren't even born there, or they have these really cool things that are happening, but because of this, you know, the weight of it all, you know? And so when that, you know, is lifted, I think then we start, you know, getting expressions of music, expressions of fashion, expression of, you know, poetry or anything else that isn't carrying on this legacy, carrying on this weight. And to talk about, you know, our community, I think there's no such thing as our community in a collective sense, because just I tell the story, but it is actually unbelievable for a lot of people. So of course there's April, Black April, and that it's commemorative and people wearing black, and it's like a mourning, a grieving 50 years after for a 20-year-old country in places like San Jose, OC. But also in Oakland, where there were a lot of international students that came pre-75 in the East Bay, let's say Berkeley, Oakland, et cetera, and the Black Panther movement, where they volunteered to send Black Panther soldiers to the North to fight, you know, imperialism and all this. On that same day, they have conferences where there are anti-war activists, where there are, like I mentioned, Black Panther and these, you know, older pre-75ers. And there's a giant size Ho Chi Minh poster on the wall as you come into like a kind of like a church or a space. And it's surreal. You know, it's surreal because it's only 50 minutes to an hour away from, you know, images of, you know, a devastated Saigon and you know, and so on and so forth. And the escapes, you know, of the last helicopter that, you know, is leaving Vietnam kind of thing, juxtaposed with a celebration of global anti-colonial struggles and also internalized colonial struggles in the United States. So it is to say that I think how we view this period is extremely complex, but that is not talked about openly is the thing that really, I guess, gets at me, because I believe that we all have different experiences and histories and our take on you know, this experience multigenerationally. And I don't think anyone has the right to suppress those voices, to then force on in terms like almost a terror type situation where they will burn down your house, you know, so arson, murder, threats, and at the very least ostracization from your family, from the community, that happens to this day, you know, to this minute. Okay. Well, and so that's a fear.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to jump in because I want to address all of this, because when I started the podcast, I wanted to move entirely away from all the war narratives. I was like, I'm done. I'm just so tired of it, listening to my entire life. But the irony is every person who comes on the podcast has something to do with the war.
Yeah.
Right. It's the irony of it. But I want to write and I want to think, I want to encourage voices that could speak beyond the pain, the trauma, the war, in the voice, for example, like Junot Diaz, when he writes, This Is How You Lose Her, and he speaks and he throws the N-word around and he's like really irreverent and he's, you know, he's misogynistic. I mean, the whole thing, it just sounds like it's, you can't listen to it today when you're reading that book, but it's not, you know, if we could have a voice like that, that's beyond the war, that's like talking about how when these people came, you know, and this is like my experience, you know, my mom and dad were in the bespoke window coverings business in LA, and we had all these interior designers come over, and they were like gay men, and they were like beautiful white aristocratic women who designed homes, and they would, you know, talk to these, you know, mid-30s. My mom and dad were in the mid-30s, can't speak English. And they were going over these designs. And I would literally see hookers walking past our like shop front in the hood. And these were like real juxtapositions that had nothing to do with the war. And I have thousands of these images that I've stored and wrote. And that's why I say, Jung, for me, I want to push back and say, there are a lot of funny moments in post-1975 living. And I was born in the United States. And I'm very close to the people who, you know, grew up in the war. And, you know, just like Christina, my parents, you know, I could write about that. But I am so tired. And then I don't want to get crucified and ostracized for not being part of the political sort of like, we talked about the pain of the suffering Olympics. I think that's what Ocean Vuong talks about. I'm done with that.
Don't start the Ocean Vuong conversation. But do you guys really feel that it's an external pressure to write about the war? Because to me, I'm just like, I don't know where that pressure people feel is coming from.
To respond to both you and Kenneth as to the pushback, I actually, you and I are aligned on this. I don't think we differ in our opinions. However, and maybe touching on what Gulen said about history, I think the struggle for me and I often see it in my students, students of color and Vietnamese students, is that we are bound to the notion of history. And I do believe in the importance of history, but we're bound to the notion of history. And within history is the housing of trauma and all of that, that somehow the act of writing into our history excavates that. What I want to say is that, yes, history is important, and yes, history needs to be documented. But also, what does it mean to reach for the imagination, right? It's like, and that is the thing that we don't do enough of within our communities, and you know, which is, how do we encourage the imagination to thrive?
Amen.
Like we fall back on this notion of history, and that's the thing. We manifest history through various modes, and it always circles back around to trauma and pain, suffering, and you know, I almost said it at the Google event, I'll see you all in 25 years, where I'll be almost like 80 something years old, and I'm still talking about my parents' lack of commitment to letting me be creative, and you know, and the war. We'll have that conversation again.
So yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people who find it kind of contradictory, because if I were a scholar or someone who didn't have to carry the weight of that war, my fascination is with Buddhism, you know, with anime, with science fiction, you know, with cooking. And a lot of that has nothing to do with the war, you know. And so those are, there are a lot of things I'm fascinated with. But apparently, when I started writing, it's the pain and the trauma that motivated me to write. But like I said before, over time, that pressure fades away, but it not completely, right? And over time, I see other artists who do fascinating thing with that war. I'm not sure you've seen that play called Viet Gone by
Kissinger. Yes, so good.
He turned it completely around, you know? It's humorous, and it's written almost from the inside out, where the Vietnamese speak fluent English and the Americans speak broken English. I just love that. And I love the way he turned it around so that you see it differently. You see the war differently. You see the refugee experience so differently. And then he moved on to write incredible plays that have nothing to do with being Vietnamese, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there are way out of the morass in that you know, if you feel obligated to write about it, then you do. And when you feel free from it, then you move on to write about something else. That's the ideal state of being an artist. On the other hand, I've been in Vietnam, where a lot of young people are deprived of real history because they're taught to not comment on society and comment on history, so that a lot of the artwork are kind of joyful, but kind of shallow at the same time, because they're self-censored. And because they don't know the depth of the history or the complexity of their own history, they can't comment on it. I'm told to read a lot of writing by young people in Vietnam, and I do, and I find them witty, and they capture the moment, the vignette, but they lack the depth because they don't know the history, their own history, or either that or they can't comment on it, so that it doesn't have any reference to the war at all.
Yeah.
So the other end of that is also ignorance. So there has to be some kind of balance to me, I think.
Yeah. I think they lack the depth because if you're not allowed to thrust fully into the sort of the ether and the abyss of the darkness, then you're muscle bound and you are not going to be able to kind of push that ability because they, I mean, most, almost nobody talks about politics.
Right. So then there's a cultural bento box that they exist within. And it can be pretty, but it never get out of the bento box.
Yeah, but I, you know, it's funny. It's yeah, for sure. And it's funny and ironic because I find that the sort of propaganda and the censorship exists both in Vietnam and the Vietnamese American quote unquote community here, where this is what I'm talking about, this self-censoring, be it, you know, the mentality you need to talk about the war and your parents' pain. And just look at our contemporary sort of Vietnamese American filmmakers, you know, their first films are always about their parents' history. It's almost like an ode to, a thing that they have to do. But I think differently, I guess, because I came so young and there I was just seeing what's in front of me. You know, there's all this talk about trauma and it's in our DNA or is passed on metaphorically or biologically, so on and so forth. But I always thought growing up that what is in Vietnamese DNA is being an artist. Because I remember we didn't have much coming here, but I would always see, you know, makeshift newsletters like our version of the zines before there were zines, okay, where, you know, they would just, people would draw and write poetry and write stories in these makeshift newsletters that they would, you know, Xerox, you know, and then it would be distributed. And so I always felt like if you have a family, you know, of more than four kids or something, you know, even 2-3 kids, you're going to make a family newsletter and you're going to, or art book or something like that, and you're going to create. And so I think innately in my mind, Vietnamese people are so creative, are so artistic. And it is almost like just a part of being that we express ourselves in this way. And so the question then is, what happened? You know, what happened along the way, either in the residuals of the wartime where there was a lot of censorship, that continues to be under, you know, the new regime, and that continues to be, you know, transported in the diaspora. But there is this shadow, you know, this shadow. And I'm very there's these moments, and the 50th anniversary, I think, is an unexpected moment for me, because as all these anniversaries come through, I feel nothing in the sense that I don't grieve in the same way, but I don't celebrate either. So I feel nothing other than, you know, where do we move forward? But this one was special. And I think maybe each anniversary, there's like, okay, enough is enough. Enough is enough. When do we get to be free to express ourselves, to write what we want to write, to teach what we want to teach, so on and so forth? When is that moment? And so I guess my question to you, Kenneth, and our, you know, wonderful group here is this the time?
Yes. Let me answer the yes. The shadow that you're talking about is actually shackles. And that shackle to me. That shackles to me is not just what we think Vietnamese government, and it happens in America, in our OC, in San Jose, these shackles and shadows and all of this, like, you know, pushback on what we can really say and what we can't. We're so afraid of, like, you know, controversy. It's already taping my mouth shut at dinner parties and I can't talk the way I want to. And I'm labeled as ignorant or subversive or whatever. It's here. It's, I call it, it's coming from Confucianism.
But I think it's an individual, but I also think we can free ourselves.
No,
I mean, I think it's different for me because I don't live in.
Yes, you don't live in the community. I've been banned from a lot of the big tables. You know, I was like friends with a lot of these wonderful people for 20 something years. The minute I just started to like go, I'm going to start talking now. And maybe I was out of line. And maybe the way I did it could have been a lot better for sure. I admit that. However, it's coming out. It's bubbling out. And I agree with you, Gulen. We need to come to a point where we need to stand up and say we should be able to say whatever we want to say. But you better be able to back this shit up.
But I think maybe that's a more authentic path for you, because maybe your path is to be that, right? And I can't speak to knowing what it feels like to be in, because I've always been like outside of community, so I can't speak to like living in it. Mm. But I don't. Maybe that's how you're supposed to go. That's the direction for to liberate yourself and then others. I don't know.
Well,
I
like being an liberation day.
There's an even more insidious consideration to this binding that you're talking about, Kenneth, which is that, you know, we speak about this as it relates to our history and our own trauma of the Vietnam War, but because we're so committed or we've been held to that consideration for so long. I mean, I show up to the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and Congressman Zoe Lofgren stands up and speaks about how 50 years ago she was fighting for human rights in Vietnam, and she will continue to fight for human rights in Vietnam, to an audience of Vietnamese Americans. And my question is, what about the human rights of our neighbors, our children here in this country, our trans children, our Palestinian neighbors? That was not spoken to. Because why? Because Zoe Lofgren is a politician, and she knows which side of her bread is buttered on. So she showed up to a Vietnamese community, and she's going to talk about the Vietnamese, talk about the politics of this moment and our responsibilities in this moment.
Right? Yeah, let me take it all the way to a teenager who I met this weekend, and who sings in our community. And her and her mother were talking about how they selected Trịnh Công Sơn songs, and then the people, protested and really upset this young girl who thought she was doing a good thing for the community. And at another event with a well-to-do, Vietnamese American, where the theme was Trịnh Công Sơn, she was able to sing it with the same audience, but they said nothing because it was money was involved and power was involved. But the point is, I asked her point blank. I said, "How do you relate to the community?" And she said, just whispers. And I said, "Say it, girl, just say it. I'm not going to judge, right?" And she said, "I have to be careful of what I say. I have to be careful of what I sing. I have to just be careful. And I know to be careful." And I felt shitty after that. I mean, it happens all the time, but to hear it from young people again and again, it doesn't feel good, because I think, maybe 20 years ago, I remember our generation was saying, "Hey, we got to fight for this. We got to fight for our freedom in the Vietnamese community, so the next generation, our children, don't have to live through this." And fast forward, our children are living through this.
So I think this goes back to the dinner table for me. Christina and I, we talk, I'm obsessed with Jewish culture. I'm just going to say it. I'm upset with the way they do things. I've dated a few Jewish women in my life, and I talk about with them, why the hell are you guys so able to have so many ideas and blah, 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 blah. And then they were like, it's almost resounding in sort of like the question that I asked. And every time it's like, oh, at the dinner table, we are free to fight our parents. We are free to have these conversations to hit back freely. And then I thought about my family. My mom and dad allowed us to do that too inside of my house. But we would go to other people's houses. Kongit hack or bang hack. That was the way that the Vietnamese treated their children at the dinner table. My parents were always like, see, we don't do that. We talk and we, and you know, my dad would crack jokes and my brother and I, my dad were on the floor rolling around and I would see piss marks on my pants, my brother, because it was so funny. And we would just get, so as I'm getting older, I'm realizing when we're singing a Jin Kong Sung song and we're afraid, it's because we are thinking back to this whole cultural, and so I think it's inside of that breeding, that inability to like really talk at the dinner table.
Right.
Say what the fuck you really feel.
This is actually something I've written about, because that Confucius-bound behavior system is very strange to me, because in my own household, my father taught us that the principle of democracy is not multi-party system at the beginning, but a way in which you can have opposition. Right. And so then I took that to heart, except for when I cai lồng, yong ya, you know, in Vietnamese, it becomes upsetting because the language doesn't allow for argument. But if I argue in English, it seems to be okay.
Wow.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, om hong dong yi ba, you know, it sounds really bad, but I say, I disagree with that, Dad. It sounds better. I think it has to do with this weird Confucius language that we also belong to, where, you know, ga gong is already have this ranking situation where it's already understood that you don't stir up the pot, you don't upset the table, basically, you know. And so in a way, English really freed me from having to play that dutiful sounding son, you know. And that Confucius thing, it's been used in Vietnam as, you know, the authoritarian regime sort of play upon it so that people have to agree with them because they're older and they're kind of patriarchal. Certainly in China, you know, with Mao, and then even now Xi Jinping is like kind of top down, and you're patriotic, therefore you're Confucian, you know, which is kind of funny because even Confucius will tell you that if the king loses heaven's mandate, he's no longer the king, right? So you got to have heaven's mandate and be moral, etc. So, you know, in my own family, my dad often wrote op-eds as well. And so he wrote one for the San Jose Mercury News during the time of Clinton, where he said, we should continue to stranglehold Vietnam, you know, keep the embargo on so that the communists will give up power. And I wrote an op-ed that was opposite, let's say, we should renew diplomatic ties so that Vietnamese will have access to the outside world. And so within my own family, that was fine. But when big family gather and visit, my uncle-in-law say, Thằng này nó phản cha, you know, this guy betrayed his father. And I was thinking, phản sounds really bad. Really, I rebelled against simply for having a different opinion, you know? And I thought, no, that actually didn't have a problem, but the community definitely did. You know, that's the problem.
And then you busted out with Kong Hung Cha Nya Ko Phu.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe that's the pattern. Maybe that's the pattern that I'm hearing, is that we had a little bit of unique upbringings. I come from multi-generational mixed race Eurasians. And so, you know, we didn't talk about politics. My family are very political, and we talk about maybe mainstream politics or something like that in the US, but we didn't talk about Vietnamese politics. So I felt freer, actually. And I think for me, at least, looking the way I look and having my name and things like that, I felt in a way, maybe a little bit adjacent kind of discrimination within the community, different types of community, you know, discrimination as a Eurasian or, you know, not quite Vietnamese, those kind of discrimination, but not discrimination like you have to follow certain, you know, guidelines. So I felt in my family and in just my upbringing, there was a more liberal, you know, way of being able to speak. So I'm curious about Jung and Christina's, you know, kind of upbringing.
I was never invited anywhere because I think people knew, including my father. He's like, you don't know how to control your mouth, which is okay. You know, my father was very open to that, right? But But I think, I mean, Andrew brings up an interesting point about language and the oppression of language in many ways in our structure, the Vietnamese language itself. I went to see that New Wave movie, and they brought in a musician who made a song for the event, and it consisted of only four lines, which is "Anh yêu em, em yêu anh, em yêu em, anh yêu anh." And they were trying to be very liberal minded and saying that we now are in this new consciousness where, you know, it's like we have to acknowledge queer love and, you know, uh-huh. you know, all that. But at the heart of that, I'm still like, but think about the structure of that language and the misogyny of that language in a sense, because it's like, you know, it's like when you say "I love you," it's it feels very, you know, even out playing field, right? You and I. But when you say "I love you" in Vietnamese, it's like there's a hierarchy to that. It's like, and we can't break from that hierarchy, and that is at the root of a lot of the struggles, like, which is we can't break from the hierarchical structure of language itself. So
it's set up in a familiar sense.
Say,
in my eye, I have multiple obligations even when you speak the language when you're not related to anybody.
We're the ông bà cô now.
Yeah.
So, you know.
You have to just go to "tao yêu mày, mày yêu tao." Right?
Yeah. I mean, and then they would say that's crass, right? That's language is crass. But, you know, it's like, hey.
Yeah, so I think that's something that should be analyzed in Vietnam, but people don't because they don't think about it, you know, so that language is it. And so when you say something that is out of bound, immediately there's a reaction of being unfilial, ông, or bắc hiếu or something, right?
Yeah.
But in fact, the home and the bắc hiếu, the rudeness, is actually the root of creativity in America.
Right.
To rebel, to say, "I disagree," or "fuck that," right?
Yeah.
The moment you say "fuck that," it's so liberating. Talk about liberation.
Yeah.
It's that you're not around by that hierarchical, familial structure that weighs down by the thousands of years, right? And so the I stands alone. The I is alone, and it is just individual thinking for itself, right? I think in a way, English language liberated me in more ways than anything else did.
But
that consciousness is pervasive, though, in a sense, and it carries itself into the consciousness of our existence here. And I circle back to that notion of what is expected of us.
Yeah.
As writers and as artists, what is expected? You can't be rude.
Yeah.
I think I was really lucky in retrospect with my dad because he basically didn't really talk to me. Like, we didn't have, so there were no, I mean, when my mom was alive, like, you know, it was the punishment or the everything would kind of channeled through her. But after she passed, he never talked to me. And it was so interesting when we were at Texas Tech at this conference. And on the panel, Jason Nguyen actually had he had an epiphany as we were doing this panel, because he said, you know, "Christina, you're," because my dad brought up, you know, Confucianism, and it's interesting because Jason basically realized, he said, you know, "Your father's silence has given you permission." So when I hear it, and that was so beautiful because Jason stood up and said this, he said, "You're at any moment, your dad could, you know, blow you up for all, like, so many things that you do and say and not be happy with it, but he doesn't." So that side, and so I look at my history now growing up, and while that was painful and sort of traumatic, I now find it liberating that my dad didn't talk to me and didn't put any, I don't have the shackles. Like, even with the book, with completing the book, with asking him for permission, like, if he would have said no, I think I still would have done it. He didn't know what I was doing till it was done. He saw the final manuscript and he gave me permission. But even if he wouldn't have, I still think I would have done it. And I feel very lucky now, like, also hearing different conversations. And I think that's why I don't feel bound by anything, because I think he never constrained me.
I think that's the sort of the connective tissue that we all have here. Andrew, Jung, I don't really know your background too well, but it just sounds like even Andrew, with opposing views, but you were able to glide through it all in English with your father. Gulin, it sounds like you had a very open, because of the Eurasian background. My father was a rebel, and you know, we were able to kind of like lean into the Jewish ways, because my father always said, look at what the Jews are, you know, Jewish people are doing. He always pointed that out, because we live in the hub of you know, working with a lot of Jewish homes and clients. And then Christina, the silence of your father. So I think, Jung, but I would love to know like how you became an artist, or sort of where you kind of found the ability to kind of be liberated in the way that you think.
Well, in my memoir, I speak about this very matter-of-factly, which is that I am extremely dyslexic. So I went through high school and most of college. I own up to this in my book, which is I've never read a book from cover to cover in my entire life. Wow. I don't read that way. So in many ways, I can't read in the way that most human beings read. So I always found a way to circumvent that. Part of it is being argumentative, because I was a literature major, and so I had to find a way to argue my points. I would argue the color green is a feminist color in Shakespeare, you know, and argue that to the hilt, right? And to the point where the professor says, okay, yeah, gotcha, right? But that was always, you know, part of my DNA, this argumentative nature. And It happened with my father. It happened with the world around me, and it always drove my creativity. But the problem with that is that when you exist in a world where the expectation is that you deliver as this vulnerable, you know, broken being by representation of who you are as a Vietnamese immigrant, then there's no room for the guy who begins and ends his book with "you motherfucker," right? And that is the book that I've been working on, right? And that is the art that I tend to work with, right? Which is art that I'm not trying to be how would you say, offensive, but confrontation is part of my art. Mm-hmm. Right, and it's something that I take very seriously. So it's always there, but it's also I write books, as I've said this before. It's like I write books that people are reading but want to put down. You know, they want to put it down because it makes them uncomfortable. They want to put it down, and I you know, I make art that makes people uncomfortable and not something you hang up to match your clothes. So that's the reality, but I know that with that reality, my audience is limited, my reach is limited, but you know, it's like what I live with.
But don't you feel more liberated in that?
No, I just feel in touch with my anger. I don't know if liberation, as it, you know, that's the weird thing, is like this language that we've been contained to says something to me that is very uncomfortable. Like I was part of the DEI committee at my school, and they told us that, oh, you're no longer called DEI, you're called the Committee of Belonging. Mm-hmm. I said, for you to say that I am now on this Committee of Belonging says that I don't belong in the first place. Mm. Right? And right. It's like, and who are you to tell me I don't belong? Who is this school to tell me that I don't belong? You know?
Yeah.
And that I have to fight for this sense of belonging? Well,
Do you think we have to fight for it? Like that's also, I mean, we've talked about language, and yeah, we are using these words of like liberation, fight, but I sometimes wonder if it's just our own individual constraints.
No, well, I mean, the committee is there for the purpose of fighting for that belonging. I mean, that's really the reality of that construct.
But advocating. I mean, I know that they're created for that purpose, yeah, to advocate or, but I'm just saying we're also in this, like, and also even just look at our conversation. We spent now like 50 minutes. It's still like, we want to talk about what's next, but yeah, where we,
I'm trying
50 minutes yeah, in.
I mean,
I'm just using that as a, you know.
Well, I'll say something because I've been at this over 30 years.
Yeah.
And I have to say that there is such thing as an evolution in the purpose of my art. You know, I think in everyone else too, if you are at it long enough. When I started, there was no one out there, and people make crazy, dumb, ignorant comment about Vietnam. Like, if you won the war, why are you here? I said, what do you mean? Like, didn't Vietnam win? They didn't even know there was a North and the South, right? So I started from that level of phase, you know? Like, bitch, there actually was a civil war. And, you know, so I started, the purpose of writing back then was like, fuck, you don't know shit, you know? And so I need to tell you, it's like, but I think as I evolve over time and that there are more people on the scene, like Christina and so on, is that whole need to educate or at least share your own experience and knowledge about that war dissipated for sure, you know? And so now I'm more fascinated with individual story, you know, homosexuality, loving now, you know. But the thing is, there is such thing as being at something and good at something for so long. It's like you're like an actor who play like bad character or evil character. They want to be something else and they got typecast.
Yeah.
A lot of us who started out and got known for something, it's really hard to move on because no one wants your other shit. You know, I was thinking of Dinh Le, who passed away, the artist. He and I have been really big, good friends in Vietnam. And Dinh, you know, did amazing weaving work of photograph that, you know, portrayed a war in his own view. And he got really famous for that. His work is still hanging in many museums. He and I have, you know, I wrote about him in one of my essays talking about how, you know, he constantly talked about moving away from that juncture, you know, and someone say, I'll pay $150,000 for the other weaving piece. And then, you know, now he's weaving that damn thing, right?
Yeah.
And so there is this weird obligation because you're known for something, like the actor who's like, I'll give you $1 million, play that evil character second time. You know what I mean? So there is always in us this longing to be free from the thing that we started, you know?
I'm going to tell a little story because Andrew and I, about 25 years ago, did a reading in Oregon. The two of us had no idea, but we showed up to do this reading, and there was a third person who read with us, this gentleman who's a little older than both of us, I think. But he got up and he started reading, and he said to this white audience, I'm so grateful because you are like my daddies.
No. You're
my mommies. You supported us. You gave us this life. You are my daddy. You are my mommy. Thank you.
No.
And I remember how cringeworthy that was to even that audience of white people in Oregon. They were all like, I don't know how to get out of this moment, right?
Yeah.
They didn't know how to fucking respond to an older white Vietnamese man calling them daddies. You know. It wasn't a gay audience, so that, you know,
yeah,
we're not gonna,
and there's no whip involved,
yeah.
So,
oh, my goodness.
But let me tell you something, he pushed to the point of cringeworthy and it was uncomfortable. But I will tell you this, white people are still there for that.
No, I know, yeah, yes,
they still want the narrative that allows them to reach their long hand behind their back and pat themselves on the back and say, that American story can only exist in America.
Yeah.
And beaming themselves. They want to flagellate themselves out of your pain.
Oh, I've been to recent events where people are thanking colonial French and colonial, Americans for bringing them to the United States. You know, thank you for, you know, the grateful refugee kind of thing, like Nguyen's work. So, I'm still hearing that, but I feel like, you know, I tell, and it's in Vietnamese communities, is in white communities actually, as well, because there's this huge disconnect between the reality of what's going on in, say, Vietnam and our diverse diaspora community and what's being told over and over again. And I hear Chung's frustration in this, and I hear, you know, Andrew talking about our friend Lê Quý Đinh. But my favorite work of his is looking at the return. Like, he talks a lot about that and that the angst of that. That's the most beautiful work, I think, for me as a returnee, you know, of sorts. And so, yeah, I think, you know, all this is happening simultaneously. And what I do is I tell my Vietnamese American and also non-Vietnamese American, it's like, hey, let me help you stop being retro, because you are so retro.
Right.
Like, you know, this stuff is very dated. And so let me get you up to speed, because I think at the end of the day, people want to know what's like happening around this. And then when they know, they're like, oh, okay. So, you know, my work and my curation and exhibits, right, is all around sort of like showing them something that's like, kind of sadly, but also needed. It's like a shock and awe.
Yeah.
What? There's cars in Vietnam? What? You know,
I think there's a need for stand-up comedians because I think we have to skewer all of that stuff.
Andrew, you can do that.
The one thing I've talked about several times is the Coochie Tunnel, right?
I was
there. I was early to come back, and there were Americans coming there, and they were crying at the mouth of the Coochie Tunnel because they couldn't find people. The Vietnam vets, you know, came back, and they couldn't find the place, and so many people died, right? But it was not the original Coochie Tunnel, because it was tiny and it collapsed already. But the Vietnamese saw it as a way to sell their version of Disneyland to American vets who wanted to see it. So then they have to dug it up, and then the Americans were too fat, so they couldn't crawl through it. So they have to open up the hole really wide so that, but then the tour guide said, you know, if it was this big, you could have found it years ago. But what I'm saying is that Vietnam itself sells the war wounds, you know, for money, you know, so it's all become commercialized, become a commodity, you know what I mean? So I think if you just kind of skewer that in some way,
yes,
the ridiculousness of all things. You know?
Yeah. That is absurd.
Yeah.
Is the bar apocalypse now still in Vietnam?
No, it's gone, but I'm sure there are other things.
I remember the blood dripping from the light sconces.
Ooh, the helicopter, you know,
yeah,
3D on that. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So I want to pick it up where Christina was like, we're 50 minutes now, we're an hour into this. And it is so funny that we are like, you know, we're hooked on the past. What is the next 50 years gonna look like for everyone in this room? But also, what should it look like? It's not only what should it look like, but what can you bring to the creative community that's not already there? What's the possibility?
Well, I'm working on a novel that's a little bit different than the war, but it does have a story that's taken place at the end of that war, but it's a little bit different. But I'm really what fascinates me, because that's what happened to me, is that whole refugee experience of a child. Because what happens to someone like me, who was living in a world where I still believe in magic, in all the superstition that I grew up with in Vietnam, the praying to ancestors, talking to ghosts, and then abruptly moved out of that, and then reaching puberty in America like half a year later, there is this weirdness where I talk about being a double refugee. You know, they force out the country, but also at the same time moving from childhood to adulthood because of some kind of historical plight, you know. And I think that's some area that I really love to explore, because there is this weirdness where you move from magic to non-magical world, you know. And also from childhood to adulthood. And that is just as shocking and, violent as leaving a country, in a way. You know.
Yeah. I'm really passionate about what just exists. The issue with that is what just exists, like in Vietnam and the diaspora, is really contentious, you know, within these two spaces across the seas. But I will say that, you know, just observing the changes in Vietnam, like, you know, my work is around fashion and fashionology and the Alzai, for example, and just seeing the transformation from 1993 is when I started doing research and living in Vietnam to, let's say, 1999, when I saw a huge transformation in industries, textile industries, and the arts, the conversions of, you know, new arts and the new ways to think about art and its connection to textile and nation and so on and so forth. And that was, for me, fascinating because it, you know, it really transcends, you know, it is very transnational, and people are talking about fashion in a way, like you can look at the Alzai and talk about the diaspora, how it's like culture in a bubble, because the same design of the Alzai went from 1975 until like 30 years after, when there was more connection with Vietnam and they saw that, oh, the Alzai is like coming back out of, you know, sort of out of favor as sort of a Western, you know, material thing under communism, to something that they can really use to represent the nation. And then so then it, you know, the funding was there and was given to artists and creating new industry of designers. And then using the Alzai to sort of showcase this development, right? And then simultaneously, all these Viet Kieu are like going to Vietnam and saying, wow, you know, I didn't know the Alzai was, is not a mini Alzai that, you know, with the palazzo pants, because that was 1975. They saw the transformation and then they were adopting it and back and forth this, you know, kind of informing each other about the aesthetics of what they want to wear on their bodies to represent Vietnam or their Vietnamese-ness or anything else for that matter. And then, and so I'm really, that's my thing. Like, you know, just looking at what is there that people want to maybe not talk about or suppress or say it's not true, but it's in the material. It's literally and figuratively, you know, the material, and moving forward and allowing the next generation, and not allowing, they're already doing it, but showcasing this, these changes and these nuances and these creations. You know, I'm an academic, but I think all my work is very, you know, artistic and culture in nature in most part, because that what moves me, and that's what I see clearly as, you know, really part of sort of the Vietnamese-ness is their ability to create under all circumstances, even under censorship, they are able to create in these interesting covert ways. And then when they're allowed, they just kind of blow up. And so that's what I'm interested in. And I think that that's the future.
Well, I'm a visual artist and a writer, and there are only two things left that I want to explore in my life. One is the notion of addressing the obscenities of our society, using obscenity to do that. So I actually use a lot of pornographic images in my work, but not because I'm trying to celebrate pornography, but I'm using obscenity to call out obscenity. So that the show that you're gonna see, if you get a chance, Christine, I know you'll be there, but that show, no more.
I think
next week I cross that you will be there. And the other thing that I'm doing as a writer is trying to explore the power that just the inherent nature of language itself, the power in language. I, you know, there's a story that I've always held on to, which is that when I was about 9 years old, I was the translator for my mom's business. She's a seamstress. My mother's specialty was that she had these boys from church come to the house and she would fit them for disco outfits. You know, that's my mother's specialty. But there was one day when I was 9 year old sitting in that room, and this hot boy comes in, and my mom told me to tell him to take off his jacket. I took the liberty of, in that moment, saying, "My mother wants you to take off your clothes," and this kid, this teenager, who clearly was fascinated with like checking out this Asian woman and very submissive, went to a bathroom and took off all his clothes and walked back out naked. My mother was screaming. Like, what is wrong with these white boys coming out naked? Oh
my God, what a great story.
And this kid goes scrambling into the bathroom, puts on his clothes, tries to apologize, and leaves. And my mother's like shooing him out the door. The entire time I'm sitting there going, I did. That was the power of language. And I tell that with great, you know, like, nostalgia, but also there's guilt there too, because I was wielding power over both my mother and this human being, right? So that's something I want to explore, that idea of what is embedded within this, the power of language and how we wield it over one another, as you know, in the
future. Yeah,
Christina.
I don't know. I mean, I was just thinking, like, all these kind of recent memories are flowing by, like, the when we talk about speaking to white audiences, for example. There was an open mic about Remembering Saigon in Santa Fe, and I said I would go just speak a little bit and then leave. And I could barely do it. I mean, I did it. And I actually, Andrew, I read that poem that I really liked of yours. Yes, remember I asked you if I could read. Because I couldn't say anything to this audience, because something in my body, I was like, I can't do this, and I'm done. And so for me right now, it's like, I kind of want to be not talking about these things. And literally, I was running out of that room right when I was done. But then it was interesting, because last weekend, Viet was in town, and these words keep coming up about, you know, confrontation, right? And I view that as, like, more myself, like, what... I'm not really working on anything right now. I mean, I think themes I want to explore, like, you know, creativity and also, like, child-free woman. And those are interesting topics for me. But I think where I am now is, like, I have to, there are, and I don't know if it's, I don't think it's related to the war per se, but just a deeper confrontation of myself. And then I'll see what I will produce after that. But it's interesting, because I see myself wanting to, like, run from all this stuff, but I also still want to help other people who are still grappling with that relationship with their parents. And even as we're doing this intergenerational book club, it's very endearing, these responses that come back, because the younger people are like, I want to do this, but my parent won't join. And I think the reason this way that there's so much assumption between the generations, like, I think it's because of this. And Jason, like, wrote a letter to one parent to try to get them, like, we're trying people. I want to help heal that. If I'm involved in the community, that's where I want to be. I want to help younger people kind of, I don't like using these words either, but for better, lack of a better word, reconcile these relationships. Because I think, but fundamentally, it's part of our evolution of being a human. Like, if we don't resolve it, I don't think we can be the best human. And resolution can just simply be acceptance, right? My dad and I are never going to talk a lot. I'm perfectly fine with that now. When he tries to talk to me more now, which he does, I don't like it. It's uncomfortable for me. And I will literally go, like what I've always done in his house, I will just go to another room. And I'm very comfortable with the dynamic. I don't want to change it. But I have learned a lot from healing that. And I think I've become a better person as a result. Mostly, like Andrew, you brought up in the Google event, like compassion, right? Compassion and understanding. These things I want to help other people get to, because I think it just helps you in life. And whether that's the Vietnamese community or broader community, but I think that's what's important to me, both helping and confronting myself. And then I'll see what happens after that.
I'm going to stretch this analogy a little bit. Hopefully it's not too bad or horrible, but when I think about Kendrick Lamar, or when I think about Tupac or Kanye, and I think about even the actual rhythm, the percussions of old, you know, slavery, working the plantations. And I think about our culture in terms of the war. How far can I deviate from the war while still making my percussive, my music, my imagery, and painting in the canvas of the guests that come on the podcast? Even in the writing that I'm pursuing, how far can I deviate from it, but making it also look and sound cool, like the way these modern hip hop artists are doing it. I don't know how far I can deviate from that, but I'm going to try. I don't know. I just have that need to try. But if it falls back on the feelings of the plantation sort of feel or rhythm, then so be it. But I do want to modernize the Vietnamese voice, whether that be through my writing or the podcast or, you know, kind of pushing other artists to think beyond the war and trauma. I want to try to do that. That's sort of my creative sort of community goals in the next 50 years of my life.
Yeah. I want to say that I'm really actually optimistic, even as we talk about gloom and doom in many ways, because I feel like inherently how we are raised, the history in which we come from, we're used to challenges. You know, in this era where, you know, there's, you know, maybe pity parties out there, or maybe, you know, whatever reactions there is also people like us that see these challenges and step up to it, you know, and know that this too will pass and that we can take active measures. And so I feel that we're not adverse to challenges. We're not adverse to barriers. In fact, like, you know, what Christina's talking about, like when things, like, you know, when there's communication, she's uncomfortable, you know, like maybe that's what it is. What if when things is like all so rosy, would we even sit in that well when we're made the way we are, when we're breaking boundaries, when we're challenging narratives, when we're creating in ways that are not expected of us, and we call these things out? I think that is just a part of who we are, actually. And I don't think it sits on woe is me, or I don't think it necessarily sits on the tragic refugee. I think if anything, it speaks to the other trope, which is the warrior, right? The revolutionary, the men and women who, you know, fight for freedom. And so I like to think of us more that way. Yeah.
I think the quality of the art and the deeper the art, or I think it depends on how honestly we confront ourselves, right? That's what I think. I mean, so I think for artists, that's what the question is like, how much can you push yourself in many different directions, both in terms of understanding, learning, becoming better at craft, but just our own walls, barriers, I mean, everything, right? I don't know, that as honestly as we can, I don't know. That's just what the confrontation work keeps coming in my mind. Did you want to say something earlier?
I'm listening to what Kenneth was saying, and there are moments though, like, and I do want to ask a question that very honestly, what do you say when someone within your own community or within your own like sphere of creativity says to you, I want to use your work, I want to promote your work, I want to teach your work, but it's not Vietnamese enough. how do you respond to something like that? I mean, I'm shocked by that commentary, and I've had it said to me, and a part of me is like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm Vietnamese.
I mean, that's how I would properly respond though. I'm like, what the fuck do you mean by that? Like, because, you know, Tan Nguyen has talked about this on the podcast about authenticity. That's like kind of like a bad word. It's a real bad word. And I was on The Splendid Table with Francis Lam on that show for NPR. And they asked about this whole idea of authenticity. And I was in the food business for 12 years. And I came up with this pho taco that I sold for 12 years, fed my family. And I said to the audience, I'm like, is that authentic? Well, it is, because I grew up on the streets of LA. Yeah. I ate tacos almost a few times a week. And my mom made pho at home. So in this body, this Vietnamese American body who grew up in the LA hood, Vietnamese pho tacos is authentic to me. So I dare anybody step up and question that authenticity, because that's authentic to my voice.
Right.
So Jung, I would fight to the death to if anybody questioned authenticity and shit's not Vietnamese enough, or right, you know, I'm not American enough. Yeah, well, right. Yeah.
Who's saying authenticity is a bad word?
I'm saying that. I say that.
How is
How was Mr. Tan Nguyen using it in his inquiry?
I don't think he's... Look, I can't really...
Questioned it.
Yeah, he's questioned it. Term. He's questioned it as a term as well, yeah. And just like I'm saying it's a bad word, I'm going like extreme, but he's questioned it in my... I'm going a little harder than he is, but he's like saying... When I used to ask all the time, what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you? I used to ask the first few hundred guests that question. He questioned that. He pushed back. He said, well, at what point could, like, what's your metric for being authentic, for being Vietnamese? So I would push back and say, even if I had a half a percent of a percent of Vietnamese-ness inside of whatever I'm doing, it's still Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when people ask you, are you Vietnamese? You know, and the, my question sits differently than, let's say, you know, this group here. But I always say, I'm Mo Cham, Mo Cham, Nuoc Mam, mm-hmm. you know, and then they're like, oh, okay. Well, that sits differently with them because they can relate to, yeah, if it's in your body, you know, and you consume it and you feel something about it, they get that as national identity.
Yeah. Right. I can be 100% American, 100% Vietnamese American, exactly. 100% Vietnamese, and 100% third culture Vietnamese as well. I can all those things.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I asked as a saying about being first-rate intelligent. I can't phrase it, but something along the line of a first-rate mind is a mind that holds opposed ideas in the head without going crazy. You know, I think identity is complicated by the fact that you can be multiple things at the same time. Yeah. You know,
in a different
so to you, you have to play the role of the alchemist to authenticate whatever it is that your experience is. You know, who cares what that label is? But, you know, at the end of the day, you create something that is beautiful to you or something that is meaningful to you. And the judge of it is actually over time. You know, did you get away with it? You know,
yeah.
And if you did, then all good for you. I mean, look at the Bible.
I asked that question because a part of me already understands that what I have to do with the reality of that situation, but also recognizing that, you know, in doing that, you're pushing yourself into an obscurity in the world, right? It's like, I mean, and a case in point, and some who's Andrew Pham, who's no longer with us. I just recently found that he passed away. He wrote Catfish and Mandela, and then he went on to write some other books that were quite geared towards science fiction. And I really admired that. He wanted to do something because I felt like that was something that he was in him and he really wanted to do. And honestly, those books never quite, you know what I mean? Because the world expected Andrew Pham to now live on a certain thing.
Right.
And 20 years later, Andrew Pham came back around and wrote another book. And I looked at the cover of that book, and it was a Vietnamese woman with a canonical hat, you know. And I got to tell you, my heart sank a little bit when I saw it. And I only saw that book after news of Andrew's passing. But my heart sank a little bit because it said that, you know, it's like, this is what the world expects of us. And in the end, this is what we have to deliver. You know, because he wrote works of science fiction. And I don't think, you know, most people, you know, when you speak of Andrew Pham, you don't speak of those works at all.
Mm.
You know, and so I'm still at a quandary. Mm. Obviously, I'm going to do what I want to do. Like Kenneth, you make your fall tacos. I know what is still put out there in terms of expectations. And part of the work that we do now is to consciously resist those expectations.
Right. And I think an important aspect is, you know, you're not alone, Jung, Andrew, Christina, you know, Kenneth, myself. We're not alone. There is a critical mass. There is community in in being different and going against perceptions, you know, and expectations. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, so much of our fear has been this fear of maybe ostracization from the family, from the community, from the connections, from the history. And I think it's important to note that, you know, we are now, you know, of an age where we have built this community over time. And that's why we're sitting here. You know, we're not in a corner going, woe is me, I'm the only one, God damn it. You know, how am I going to fight against the machine kind of thing, you know? I think there's that. And I hope there's that. And I think if it's not clear enough, I think we should be in a position to make that change. If not for anything, really, you know, helping to carry on some legacy of the art, the people who came before us and unfortunately, and to Ex-Fam, but also Lekwi Duk, you know, Phuong Ai Nguyen, Jenny Doe, Lekwi Ding, you know, these are 1.5 gen folks that have recently passed, or Charles Phan, you know. Yeah. So these are people who we care about, who were the frontiers people in food, in art, pioneers in beverage, and, you know, on both sides of the shore. And we miss them, and we love them, and I haven't gotten over these losses. I'm still grieving them. And you know, some of my questions were, it's a weird one, but it's like, these are 1.5ers. Many of us here are. There's two second gens here, at least, and like Kenneth and Christina. But, you know, why is it that our parents who've been, you know, minimally been through 1, 2, 3 wars and, you know, managed to live to old age, you know, displacement, you know, in a different country, new language, you know, making their way. And so that we can have a life in many ways. And they managed to get to a certain age and they are still alive. And here are compatriots that we know of have passed on, you know, before their time, really. And I wonder, you know, what was it, or what is it that is creating this wave of people we love and lose?
I think about this a lot. My very superficial answer is they did their job and they finished.
No.
And that is beautiful. And that is the truth of it.
Well, I hope I'm not finished with my job, Jesus. For the most part, they're younger than me. God. And they're all my friends. So therefore, I've been mourning for the last year.
I mean, that's the only way I can make sense of it, is that they were finished with their mission, because the Phuong Ai was such a beautiful soul. I mean, from day one, you know, she had a restaurant in LA in the 90s called Dominic's, and we would just come and hang out with her. And then to Q Bar. And
well, she's like my sister. So I cry my eyes out for 3 days.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we can go on and on about these people. They've just left their good hearts. Yeah. And they've left such a strong legacy. And you know, we carry it on in many ways, and we create our own paths as well. But yeah, and I agree with you, Kenneth. I think that's a beautiful spiritual thing. And I think that's what it is. And I truly believe it. We come by choice with a mission that we want to have. And when we're done, we're done.
Well, I think we can honor them by being creative always.
Yes.
Absolutely. And being fearless.
Yeah.
And being fearless in this creation and finding community with each other. Because I'm sure that at points they felt they were the only ones doing things.
Yeah.
Going up against the grain.
You know, yeah. I want to end it here, but I also want to let the audience know that if you enjoyed this, I'd love to put this super panel back together. I'd like to hear in the comments any subject that you want to hear from this panel of people, because this is a special group that Christina kind of curated and brought together. So thank you, Christina, for this wonderful talk. It was so liberating. Thank you, Kyulin, Andrew, Jung, and Christina, so much for being on the Vietnamese podcast today.
It's great. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Keep up the great work getting the voice out.
Do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok @The Vietnamese Podcast.